Africa Now. Today's show features Sudan, Darfur, and civic society mobilization during conflict. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Muizo Montali. The music in the background is Fiez Alil by Abel Karim Al-Kabli. January 1st was Sudan's 70th anniversary of independence. Sadly, the occasion is overshadowed by the nearly three-year conflict in the Sudan between the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF. Since the war commenced on April 15, 2023, 14 million people have been displaced, internally and externally as refugees abroad. Tens of thousands have been killed, and out of a population of 50 million, over 21 million people face acute food insecurity. Thus, because of the war, Sudan faces the world's largest humanitarian disaster. In the Darfur region of Sudan, the humanitarian crisis has intensified in the past few months following the fall of El-Fasher, the capital of North Darfur, to the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, in late October 2025. According to an Al Jazeera report, recently a UN team finally was able to go to El-Fasher and said the deserted city was, quote, a crime scene. Joining the show today to unpack the current situation in Darfur and civic mobilization in the midst of conflict is Nimat Ahmadi. She is the president and founder of Darfur Women Action Group. Here is my recent conversation with Nimat Ahmadi. Nimat Ahmadi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I should say welcome back to the show. It's been a while, but at least welcome back. And I wanted to start, you know, this January 1st was Sudan's 70th Independence Day anniversary, actually. And also this past week we saw in Western Darfur, where 114 people were killed. If you could give us the broad situation on the ground in Sudan in the midst of the war between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces.
Thank you for the opportunity. I think, as you mentioned, it's very unfortunate and sad to see 70 years after the independence of Sudan from the colonial, that we are still not actually independent today. And the situation has been really deteriorated and backwarded in a way that never happened probably in any other country. As we start the year, people are still mourning their loved one from the devastated attack in El-Fasher, where thousands of people have been murdered. Many people have gone missing, appeared to be recovered. Children lost their family and left to wander around. Families lost their children. They don't know their whereabouts. And I personally lost several family members, immediate family members, like my immediate cousins, two of my younger uncle's sons were killed, and their bodies have yet to be recovered. An older cousin who was killed, and he just yesterday we received the terrible news of, like, finally people can cry and mourn that his body was recovered, because this is the example of thousands of people who have been shot, led to bleed, and they bled to death because there was no access to medical attention because the Arabic Support Forces has, as they were attacking and killing people, they block the city and block those people who are trying to render help to their loved ones. And people fled into different directions. Some of them are still seeking a safe space. I was just in a meeting with several groups who are working on the ground today, and they were talking about people who just arrived today since they fled Al-Fashir. Imagine from October 26 until today, people are still lingering around to find a safer space to stay. And they now hear that there are some local actors and NGOs operating in Tawila. So unfortunately, they are not taking the humanitarian assistance the way people need. So people now have to migrate like miles and miles away to reach a place that where there is a drop of humanitarian assistance, and which is very sad. Very.
Yeah, before I go on, I just send my condolences to the loss of your loved ones and all the tragedies you're going through. And it's your microcosm of what's happening, I guess, with many, many people, in, particularly in Darfur, where you're from and where you work on. And the Darfur, you know, there's been a continuous attacks on people in Darfur since the early 2000s, even though of course now it's much worse in, with because of this civil war, but there has been continuous attacks and on people in Darfur. What's the difference now compared to the past, in particularly Darfur? Yeah.
Well, the unfortunately true, these attacks was never ceased. Since 2003, the first genocide in the 21st century was reported in Darfur, where millions of people, about 4 million people, have been forced to flee, and more than 300,000 people have been killed. Many people remain in the internally displaced camps around Al-Fashir, Niala, Al-Junaynah, all the cities that now have been destroyed again, and those who fled have been attacked again. But the difference back then, it was the government of Al-Bashir who sponsored the militia called Janjaweed from Arab origins, have been equipped, mobilized, and trained to kill the indigenous African. So the nature of the attack and the players may have slightly shifted, but they're the same. Like, it's the same Janjaweed militias who have been upgraded into Rapid Support Forces. But the difference is that the Janjaweed, which used to be on camel and horses' backs, today they are in advanced land cruiser, well equipped. They have machine guns. They have advanced technology. They use drones, and they can have mobile communication means whereby all this, like their vehicles, are well equipped wherever they go. They have all what they need to track people, even individuals, innocent civilians, as they flee. And now they also have powerful actors in the region, like the United Arab Emirates, who completely sponsor and supported the Rapid Support Forces, even when they themselves are feeling tired and they want to flee and abandon the world. They regroup them, give them more equipment and ammunition and money to push them to continue to fight. So because of that, then also another difference is that the attack back in the days was mostly concentrated in the villages and remote areas, whereby people flee into these large cities like the Al-Fashir, the capital of the historical capital of the Darfur region, and then Al-Junaynah, Niala, Zalinji, Kabkabiya. All these cities have the largest displaced. There was 22 internally displaced camps before this recent war started. Now the attack was shifted and reconcentrated into the places where the large number of internal displaced people reside, and specifically dismantling the camps, like the attack in Zamzam camp, attack in Abu Shouf camp, and the attack in Al-Fashir. Al-Fashir housing the largest number of internally displaced people before, because in the early days of this recent war, it was there was a ceasefire in Al-Fashir, and there was like a little bit of calm situation before the siege and the attack that imposed by the Arabi support forces. So everyone saw they can come to Al-Fashir. But now the attack is systematically directed to all the cities that are housing the most vulnerable people who fled from 2003, 2004. And it's also now there is no humanitarian aid organization on the ground. On April 15, 2023, when the war erupted, all the internationals have fled Sudan, and particularly Darfur fall under the control of the Arab support forces. For the last 2 years, major cities like Al Junaina, where 15,000 indigenous Africans were murdered in West Darfur, and in Niala, where countless people, nobody today knows the accurate count of people died in Niala because remain a stronghold of the Arab support forces, and no one can dare to go there. And then now, after the fall of Al-Fashir, Darfur become a completely locked areas under the rabbit support forces, and now even locally led organizations, they can hardly operate on the ground. So as I speak to you, people are dying in silence. Back in the days when people flee into these towns, citizens, local community will come to the rescue. They bring food, they bring water, and they could also have almost like a slight access to communication. But today, the water sources was targeted, electric supply sources were targeted, and the communication infrastructure is targeted. So people are cut off. Like when people go away from Starlink, they have no communication, and that's why people who fled Al-Fashir, they are still roaming around. These are the people who are able to survive, but many, many more have died because they could not reach safety, and nobody can reach them. And so the difference is that the similarity is that always it is not a civil war. It is a systemic atrocities being committed by the powerful against those who are powerless, but they are ethnically singled out and targeted to be killed by another ethnic group that is favored and supported, not just by the previous government in Sudan, but by the current like regional actors who are also of Arab origin. So you have to understand this dynamic. And I think the nature of the current war and in Sudan, it's not just targeting Sudan. It is about the continent of Africa. And I think it needs like I think African people need to pay attention to Sudan and understand it.
Again, that's Nimet Amadi. She's the president and founder of Darfur Women Action Group. And we're looking at the situation in Sudan, looking at the civic society mobilization in the midst of conflict, and particularly also highlighting the situation in Darfur, nearly almost 3 years after the war, which has been taking place between the two groups of the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces. And yeah, thank you for making those connections of the who's funding and supporting it in the Gulf. We've been trying to make sure people understand the regional dynamics of the Gulf states within particularly UAE involved in this conflict. That it's not just an internal issue, that there's actually this play for resources because UAE is also getting gold out of Sudan, right?
Yes, absolutely. The reason for this are resources, because Sudan is very rich of resources, and therefore is the richest region in terms of gold, other minerals, including oil that have yet to be explored, and then agricultural land, something that all these Gulf state and Middle Eastern they don't have, and the livestock, and also the gum, Arabic. Gum is like Sudan can export, like contribute like 80% of the total gum export. All comes from Darfur and Kordofan. So you can imagine. And now, when the country is completely destroyed and in a state of chaos, they have the ability, the United Arab Emirates, the planes that are landing in South Darfur, Niala, every day they are cutting these resources into the UAE. So they don't want to pay for the gold. And this is the best type of gold, which is like 24 karat. It's like in comparison with many other like gold, it's like one of the top internationally. And so you can imagine. So its resource has, but also the ethnic nature of the attack. Like even as they are seeking and fighting for resources, they are ethnically targeting this indigenous African in their land because they cannot associate with Arabism. They are indigenous. They have pride. They hold onto their culture, their languages, and they're also the land owners. Like they, even though the Arab tribes who came in like some of them in late like 19th century, and then until then like 20th and 21st century, who came recently, they were allocated land. They were given territories, so they are not landless. But it's still. That was it's not enough because they want to remove these people from their land, ethnically motivated, so that they can expand their Arab nationalism across Africa.
And in the midst of all this, there are civic society organizations working at the moment, because you mentioned that just at the beginning, you're saying that humanitarian organizations have left, but there's still like indigenous civic society groups who are doing some work, making sure that they're assisting people, particularly in Darfur, but also countrywide. If you could talk a little bit about the civic society mobilization, what are some of the things that they've been doing to really be the unofficial? Well, basically they're the governments really be doing the work of what governments should be doing.
Well, of course, the civil society group, community-based organization, volunteers. These are the people who step up, like for us who are in the diaspora, when the war erupted and everyone has left the Sudan, we felt like the end of the world. And but soon after, like immediately, local community leaders existing, especially in Darfur and in places like South Kordofan and the Blue Nile, there are organizations that have worked, locally led organizations that have worked in the humanitarian like field and in 4 years since 2003 and even before. And because of that, they immediately step up. Where first, like, start gathering resources from within the community, then they were aided also by the diaspora. So us in the diaspora, we immediately start mobilizing our resources, gathering funds, and deploying it to help our people. So I can say confidently that because of the work that civil society, community-based organization, and like Darfurian Sudanese-led organization did, that people who have been able to survive are able to survive. Because otherwise, at the moment, like the first 6 months into the war, there was no international NGO on the ground, not even in Sudan. Like even the national staff, some of them are relocated into the neighboring countries. So you like they really are doing remarkable work, and especially the work that the government is supposed to be doing, including protection, relocating of survivors, helping people evacuate dangerous places, helping those who are wounded and left to suffer, and seeking medical attention. All this effort that was supposed to be done by the government is done by local people, by the local NGOs and community-based organizations. And this is like really, unfortunately, this has been going on, but it's not has yet to be recognized because it's still funding goes to the large, well-established international organization who have no presence on the ground. And this has to be changed. This has to be changed. I think it's important that people who are on the ground in the front lines have an ability to decide in where funding is being allocated and how and who should be receiving this funding, because dynamics in Sudan has changed. In Sudan, we have The reason we are facing and battling war right now is because of the elitism, a few individuals in the center that have been marginalizing the actual Sudanese people for years, manipulating power. The same thing in the civil society. There are center-based civil society organizations who all like right now sitting in Cairo, in Kampala, in like Middle East, and they can continue to compete and try to take over the funding versus enabling the organization to allocate funding for these groups. And that is the battle that right now those who are on the ground aiding their people have to fight, because they don't have time to attend like international meetings or regional meetings. They are on the ground rightly helping people and saving life.
And some of those people on the ground, they were involved in the December 8, 2018 uprisings, right? Some of those people who were working on the ground, they were like the what they called resistance committees and all that. And those people, some of them, I think, are still in Sudan, but some had to leave, right?
I think a resistance committee is part of the largest civil society or like, say, locally led humanitarian organization. So I think there is something lost in translation, and also there was like some maybe intentional exclusion. Like you hear a lot about the resistance committee, you don't hear about community-based organization, IDBs-led organization. You don't hear about the indigenous-led organization. So even at the uprising where in Khartoum, these people were like in Darfur and in South Kordofan or the Blue Nile, they're working day and night. Like during the interim period, they have gotten nothing. So the resistance committee, they are the one, the emergency room. Many of them have left the country right now. They're in the diaspora. Of course, they still have people on the ground, but these are Khartoum-based, because in Khartoum, back in the days, there are civil society organizations like who are like, you know, top-down kind, but they were not locally led. That is why resistance committees, they converted into emergency rooms. And that is very applicable in Khartoum, in Al Jazeera, in other areas. But in Darfur, in other places, the overwhelming majority are women-led civil society, community-based organizations. CBOs are large in Darfur. IDPs-led organization, youth-led organization. But unfortunately, they have been overshadowed. Like internationally, many, many people talk about the resistance committee or the emergency rooms, but they don't talk. And that is kind of the struggle that right now we are trying to have the international community and the international organization understand that in Darfur, actually, there are a largest number, like hundreds of locally led community-based organizations who have gone nowhere, but they also have a huge capacity that has been built over 30 plus years. And some of them, like the least of them, have been working not less than 15 years. They are not just emerged. But then, like, it depends on who have access to communication, who have access to those platforms. And right now, because the emergency room, they have people sitting in the diaspora in various neighboring countries. And they also, most of, like, they have members, people who studied overseas. These are the people when the Darfur genocide was raging, they were safe enough to engage in education. So the balance, to strike the balance is very hard right now. But I also want people who are listening to this to understand that the overwhelming majority are the community-based national civil society, national NGOs are the ones who are doing the work, actually. Until the Fajr fall, we have six national organizations who remain there, including our Women Action Group, Sudan. And then it's still the organization operating in Niala, in some of the hard-to-reach areas like Jabal Marra. And in some places that are controlled by the Arabic Support Forces, people could not name their organization, but they do community initiative so that they can protect themselves to be able to aid the people.
And speaking of the Darfur Women Action Group, your organization, and I was just looking at a report about the effects of the systematic violence against women. And there was a recent study by A report by this Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, which this was reported in Al Jazeera. They reported nearly 1,300 cases of sexual violence, attributing to 87% of them to the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces. Of course, there's also violence against women by the Sudanese. The Sudan Armed Forces, SAF, but the majority seems to be from the RSF. And as you mentioned before, they're using this, it's being used as a war, weapon of war, particularly against non-Arab groups. If we could expand a bit more about this, particularly in your work, because you deal with looking at women's issues and the women that you've been working with to highlight this issue and make also to support the people who have been impacted on this violence.
Oh, unfortunately, it is unbelievable. Large number of women and children have been impacted by sexual and gender-based violence. In the evening of the fall of Al-Fashir, the Rapid Support Force, after they stormed the city, they went house after house. They murdered. They went into large gatherings where a group of people gathers at places that they think it will be protected. Or either like more, it's harder to be destroyed or to be barred. And then they were killing the men and raping the women overnight. A large number of women fled to Tawila. And until recently, like there are cases of women who have been abducted and have yet to be recovered. So on some of them, they just fled and they couldn't even receive any kind of assistance because the place is isolated. And even though before the fall of Al-Fashir, people can be able to have access to hospitals, but right now that's not the case unless they have to reach Tawila. But even as they reach Tawila, they cannot speak because they are so afraid that now RSF controlling everywhere in Darfur. And that there is credible fear and potential for retaliation against this group. So we have one of the centers. I'm not going to mention the name, but like between the attack in Zamzam and Al-Fashir, we have received more than 100, 350 cases. Most of them have yet to receive assistance. It's overwhelming and discouraging and dismaying. And we have about 160 cases of sexual assault and complication of like reproductive health complication as a result of that, but they have yet to receive assistance. Like some people were relocated or assisted to go into places where AmaSafe is operating, but many more are unable to reach those. So I think like the attack on women is part of the strategy. It's not just at random. Soldiers or militias roaming around, but it is very, very systematic in nature and scope.
And also the other thing that's happening is the use of the drones by both sides. How has that impacted Darfur in particular?
Absolutely difficult. I think many people who have been killed in Al-Fashir in the leading up to the fall of Al-Fashir were killed by drone. Both sides have used drone, but the RSF mostly use target civilians, population areas. In some places, you know, like people, unfortunately, even to have to say this, but people say with drone, especially in some places, they said drones are like more targeted, like a specific area versus like the airplane bombardment previously that would have been impacting many more people. So right now, but RSF's just shooting their drone in people, like they're shooting schools. They're shooting places where people gather, like people who were killed in Al-Fashir University. These are most of them are like professor, health workers, and others. So it's really It depends on like who is using it and how they want to use it. And that kind of giving them an advantage. They don't need to go into place to kill people. They will just send drones. And these drones are like targeted into like places of gathering. They can go and fall into a market or a hospital or a school or gathering of children or women in a place seeking assistance.
And finally, before you go, I wanted to find out what ordinary citizens on the ground are demanding for, what are their main demands for the demands on the warring factions and also international organizations, particularly the African Union, since this is in the continent of Africa, but also the UN.
Really, the civil society organization on the ground, they want to see African Union take more leadership and involving in civilian protection and also opening up access and standing up for Imarat. For UN agencies and international NGOs, they want a strong UN presence on the ground. They're asking for civilian protection. Everywhere you go, people are asking for protection because right now people can't travel, people can't carry humanitarian aid, people can't carry goods, people can't carry even the wounded or the sick people, people can't travel. So they need access to roads, safe access, safe passages, and then also having this locally led organization, especially if in Darfur, and being Darfur now the most impacted and the most in need. Plus Kordofan, they need to be on that decision-making like table because when this humanitarian allocation of funding are discussed, this then like our people are absent because they're on the ground doing the life-saving work.
Nimat Amadi, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you have a lot to do, and you have, and also dealing with so much, with personally and professionally. So thank you for taking the time to be with us on the show.
Thank you, Mirza, for the opportunity. It was a pleasure to speaking with you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
And that was a recent conversation I had with Nimat Amadi, who is the president and founder of Darfur Women Action Group. And she was unpacking the current situation in Darfur and civic mobilization in the midst of the conflict in Sudan. You can revisit the conversation on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is from Darfur. It's Darfur music. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. And now the show will feature a poem from Sudan entitled Alien Suite by Safia El Hilo. This was a poem that was played at Sankofa Video and Books program, Sudan on Our Mind, on October 19, 2025. Here is the poem Alien Suite by Safia El Hilo.
نسم علينا الهوى من مفرق الوادي يا هوى دخل الهوى خدني على بلادي Fact. The Arabic word hawa means wind. The Arabic word hawa means love. Test. Multiple choice. عبد الحليم said, You left me holding wind in my hands. Or عبد الحليم said, You left me holding love in my hands. Abd al-Halim was left empty, or Abd al-Halim was left full. Fairuz said, O wind, take me to my country. Or Fairuz said, O love, take me to my country. Fairuz is looking for vehicle, or Fairuz is looking for fuel. Kalthum said, Where the wind stops her ships, we stop ours. Or Kalthum said, Where love stops her ships, we stop ours. Kalthum is stuck, or Kalthum is home. Did our mothers invent loneliness, or did it make them our mothers? Were we fathered by silence or just looking to explain away this gaping quiet? Is it wasteful or wistful to pray for our brothers in a language they never learned? Whose daughters are we if we grow old before our mothers or for their sakes? They called our grandfathers the January children, lined up by the colonizer and assigned birth years by height. There is no answer because we come from men who do not know when they were born, who married women shown to them in photographs, whose children left the country and tried for romance and had daughters full of all the wrong language. One, at the musicians' club in Omdurman, a singer is stabbed to death for playing secular music. The month before, a violinist on his way home is beaten by police, his instrument smashed to matchwood. All the bars in Khartoum are closed down. All the alcohol in Khartoum poured into the Nile. A new law forbids women from dancing in the presence of men. Another banned song lyrics that mention women's bodies. Two, at a party in Omdurman, lights strung among the date palms, my not yet mother, honey legs in a skirt, opens her mouth and the night air is the gap in her teeth. She sings in the lilting English to a slow song, while bodies around her pair off and press close. Before he is my father smokes a cigarette and shows all his teeth when he laughs. Wants to ask the dark gold girl how her English got so good, what the words mean, and could he sing something sometime into the gap in her teeth. But first, police arrive, rip lanterns from trees and fire a shot through the final notes of the song. And tonight, my parents do not meet. But I imagine Khartoum as it was in the 80s, my mother with ribbons in her hair, dress fanning about her nutmeg calves, my father, who I hear was so lively and handsome that only bad magic could have emptied that and filled him with smoke, the borrowed record player, the generation that would leave to make nostalgia of these nights, to hyphenate their children and grow gnarled by diasporas every winter. But tonight, Motown crackling in the hot twilight, mosquitoes swaying in the velvet dusk, my parents dance without ever touching. And now my mother harbors her country's music in her lungs. These songs, the only things she got in the divorce. There is a TV show we used to watch when we lived in Egypt, where a group of Sudanese youth sing old Sudani love songs. We don't get the channel here in the US. Tonight, my mother finds every episode on YouTube. After a quiet dinner of leftovers at the kitchen counter, because it's just us two, my brother is out being 21 and popular. My mother and I sit together in the half light and eat mango with our hands and listen to Asim al-Banna sing Fit Taif, and I never hear love songs like this in English. Songs that are as much about a country as they are about a woman. Songs where woman is country. Before we grew bitter and learned not to make a world out of a person, learned not to make a world out of a country, because even your mother's country can betray you. My mother's country broke her heart and I want to cry, picturing her eating mango alone in the dark, singing to herself. My brother and I, a world away, with our fast English and our hip-hop and our late nights. We are not from a world where love songs are like this. We are not romantic. We are not considerate. We forget to call. We do not bother to phone the cable people to ask for the channel with my mother's favorite show. We do not bother to teach her how to bookmark videos on YouTube, how to download all the old love songs into her iTunes, how to buy mango already sliced, packaged in neat plastic tubs. But the story goes, my father would never unwrap a piece of gum without saving half from my mother. The story goes, my mother saved all the halves in a jar. That's not the point. I'm not looking for anything serious, just someone to watch my plants when I'm gone. You can sing now if you want to. They're worried no one will marry me. I have an accent in every language. I want to be left alone, but that's not how you make grandchildren. I can't go home with you. Home is a place in time. That's not how you get me to dance. I'm not from here. I'm not from anywhere. I mean to say that I don't know that song. I mean to say that my body is a pill, small, and love is the wrong man's tongue to tell me so. My body dissolves. My body finds men who are water and calls them home. My body is everything that happened to me. Love is a thing my body borrows to forget. Love is a pill. My body is water. My body is a tongue, and love dissolves. Love calls the wrong man home. Love makes my body a stain and goes looking for water on the wrong man's tongue. Love is a house. My body is a bath drawn in floodwater. My body trickles in through the floorboards. Love is the carpet that I've ruined. Love is decoration. Love is an alternative to water. Love is just something to do until the wars start. My body is a border drawn up by some man long ago. Love is everything that happened in between. Love is the floorboards. My body is decoration. Love ruined all the carpets. My body is the carpet. My body is the stain. Love makes it all dissolve. Love is an alternative to home. Love is floodwater. My body burned to the ground. My body called the wrong man home. Love started the fire. My body is everything that happened after. The wrong man is an alternative to love. The wrong man is a map. Home is where he puts the lines. My body is a border drawn by accident, by the wrong man's tongue. Love makes scars on my body and calls them borders. The wrong man mistakes my body for a body of water. Love let the wrong man decide what my body mistakes for home. Love started the fire. My body is a house on fire. My body drew a bath in flood water. The wrong man is flood water. Love and the wrong man are an alternative to hating my body. My body is a body of water poured over everything that happened to me. My body makes every scar an island. The wrong man makes my body small, a pill. Love makes the water, and my body dissolves. But when love flickers in the corners, it opens in me what I pretend is a need to confess, what is actually just a need to blame everything for my cowardice, this preference for men whose daughters will not have my eyes. Anyone who threatens to matter, who's not my preferred shade of disposable, whose shoulders are enough to tell me that I will succumb to the softness that I spent a lifetime coaching out of this body, this is the one that I will crowd out the door and say that I am protecting him from my love, from everything that it is not. I will say, a woman betrayed by her own body will never keep any of your secrets. I will say, most men are afraid of me, you know. Or I will say, in my culture, we do not take our men's names as our own. You have nothing for me. I have my own name, one letter away from my mother's. I know now how this body works, how it will never let a name go once it has taken it into the mouth and fed it to the breath. I still know, by heart, the phone numbers of the ones who have lied the most. It was they who I loved best. I let them name me in their language until I forgot every word of my own. Now every mouthful of me is gone, caught between the teeth of liars who hiss when they laugh and will load a whisper with the kind of spells that can convince a girl that she is nobody's daughter. Or I will say, my mother and I are women who look like nobody's wives, the strong girls, inheritors of every bitterness of a country racked by war until it broke itself in half. We are the tapered point of a horizon line of women who've learned to cook dinner every night, whether or not the men come home, who spit their daughters out an ocean away to save them from this land that will drink up all its children just to show the stains off to the world. Lover, the whole world knows the color of my people's blood. Lover, I am a girl without a country, carrier of an ancient lost lover. I cannot keep house. I haven't enough language to name a child with. Lover, in loving you, I betray all the left behind women in my blood. I've left my home behind once already. I cannot survive another loss. Or I will blame my father. I will say, my father is a backwards glance. My father is a whispered breath. My father is forgotten and I have his face. A skull pierced by the eyes of a man who left makes me the girl who leaves. These are the heirlooms that I've got. My father is a stranger. Every man is a stranger. Once, I let a stranger introduce himself with his hands. I've been trying to remember my own name ever since. Through the saxophone's mournful syrup, shiver of guitar, and a smoke-eyed voice studded with the names of all our dead boys and all our burned cities. And now the lyrics do not translate. Arabic is all verbs for what stays still in other languages. Tasbah, to mourning, what the translation to awake cannot honor, cannot contain its rhyme with tasbah, to swim, to make the night a body of water. I am here now and I cannot mourning. I am 25 and always sick, small for my age and always translating. I cannot sleep through the night. No language has given me the rhyme between ocean and wound that I know to be true. Sometimes, when the doctors draw my blood, I feel the word at the edge of my tongue. Halim sings, Aghraq, Aghraq. I am drowning, I am drowning. The single word for all the water in his throat does not translate. Halim sings, teach me to kill the tear in its duct. Halim sings, I have no experience in love, nor have I a boat. And I know he cannot rest, cannot swim through the night. I am looking for a voice with a wound in it, a man who could only have died by a form of drowning. Let the song take its time. Let the ocean close back up. Republic of the Sudan, Ministry of Interior, Passport and Immigration General Directorate, Alien from Sudanese Origin Pass Card. At the government office, a veiled woman made the card on Microsoft Paint. Told me my Arabic was not bad for a foreigner, you can barely hear the accent. I board the plane with grandma's voice crackling through the phone. Today we queued for fuel and food. Come home again soon. My blue passport made me American, place of birth, Maryland, USA. And in the months since my last visit, I feel the American slur settle back to coat my R's. And in New York, I am ambiguous brown girl, Sudanese, but your English is so good, you can barely hear the accent. Mama still speaks to me in Arabic here, but we eat with fork and knife. We play some of the old songs, but mostly Motown, to remind Mama of those swaying 80s nights in the garden, before it turned to dust, before the old country crumbled, and Mama came here to give me the blue passport for freedom. And last time I was home, a soldier stopped the car, asked for ID, held the stiff navy blue marked Maryland, USA, asked where I was from, laughed when I said here. Alternate ending. The dead boy is poured back into his body. I try to leave home, but the ocean bares its teeth. And where I'm from is where I'm from and not where I was put. It's morning, and my grandmother pins hot colors to the clothesline. It's evening, I'm still on a date, and the words, say something to me in Arabic, fall backwards down his throat. And what is a country but the drawing of a line? Today I draw thick black lines around my eyes and they are a country. And thick red lines around my lips and they are a country. And the knife that chops the onions draws a smooth line through my finger and that is a country. And the tightening denim presses a soft purple line into my belly. And when I smile like my mother, a line flashes in between my two front teeth. And for every country I lose, I make another, and I make another. And I believe that sometimes we do not die. I will not believe that to be housed in a body that is black is to be always dressed in black for the funeral. We live forever. Sometimes our mouths open and a song falls out, thick with a saxophone syrup. And all our dead in the ground make this land ours. And all our missing fathers make us everything's child. Today I did not dress for a funeral. Today I wear the yellow dress and laugh with all my teeth. Today my lost ones are not lost to me. They live in the wind that gathers my skirt. Today this is my country. Today I say their names and all the holes left behind, shaped like black girls and black boys, are lit up by hundreds of faraway stars. Today I woke up and was not dead. And tomorrow might be different, but tomorrow does not yet exist. So I hold my mother's hand and kiss the brown valley between each knuckle. My brother opens his mouth to laugh and the light pours in through the gap in his teeth. I press my body to a man that I find beautiful and sway to a song that knows us. I live forever with my feet in my grandmother's lap. I live forever by the water with the sun spilled over me. Remember me this way. And when they come for me, play the song I love into the space I leave behind. Thank you.
And that was a poem from Sudan entitled Alien Suite by Safia El Hilo. And that was a poem that was played at the Sankofa Video and Books Program, Sudan on Our Mind, on October 19, 2025. The poem is available on Sankofa's YouTube page. Earlier on, you heard a discussion with Nimat Ahmadi. She's the president and founder of Darfur Women Action Group. She was unpacking the current situation in Darfur and civic mobilization in the midst of conflict. You can revisit that conversation also on African Now SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is All Africa by Max Roach, and we play that commemorating his birthday, which is January 10. That's it for African Now for today. I'm your host, Muizo Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly spotlighting the issues concerning Palestinians. And after that is the women's collective Sophie's Parlor. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter, at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nicella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Josh Myers, Kurt Erdiston, Chanda Kozer, and Fona Ngonda. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And thank you for joining us, and thank you for your continued support of Africa Now and all the great programs on WPFW this past year, and we look forward to being together this year. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Sudan in the Heart of Africa by Kamal Kaila. Thank you. Have a great day, have a great week, and stay safe.
Alpha Town. I remember Napta now. Take me to Karima Town. Let me see the Hamadab.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. In breaking news, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said his public safety team is responding to a deadly ICE-related shooting in Minneapolis this morning that left one woman dead. Responding to the killing, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey is calling for ICE agents to leave the city immediately. This comes as the Trump administration has launched what officials describe as the largest federal immigration enforcement operation ever carried out, and tied in part to allegations with little evidence of fraud involving Somali residents. A person briefed on the operation told the Associated Press the Department of Homeland Security plans to dispatch as many as 2,000 officers to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. In his post on social media, Mayor Frey stated, quote, "The presence of federal immigration enforcement agents is causing chaos in our city. We are demanding ICE to leave the city immediately. We stand rock solid with our immigrant and refugee communities." Close quote. In more news, hours after the U.S. military invaded Venezuela and kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, President Trump made it clear that his intent is to take control of Venezuela's oil reserves, thought to be the largest in the world. How that will actually play out is now coming into focus. Trump has said he wants Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, to give the U.S. and private companies total access to Venezuela's oil industry, and yesterday on social media, Trump stated that Venezuela would send 30 million to 50 million barrels of oil to the U.S., and that he would control the profits from those sales. Today, Energy Secretary Chris Wright said the U.S. intends to sell Venezuelan oil indefinitely. In doing so, the U.S. blatantly violates the principle of permanent sovereignty over natural resources adopted by the U.N. General Assembly in 1962, which states that sovereign states alone have the inherent right to control, use, and dispose of their resources for their own development. In related news, following a more than two-week pursuit, U.S. forces today seized a Venezuela-linked oil tanker escorted by a Russian submarine in the Atlantic Ocean for alleged violations of U.S. sanctions. The Kremlin responded angrily to the seizure, saying, quote, "No state has the right to use force against ships properly registered in the jurisdictions of other states," close quote. And after taking over Venezuela, President Trump is doubling down on his intent to bring Greenland under U.S. control. In a statement yesterday, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said Trump and his team are reviewing, quote, "a range of options," close quote, to pursue that goal, and made clear that military force has not been ruled out. Greenland possesses significant natural resources, including oil and gas, and vast deposits of rare earth elements, even as President Trump insists his designs on the island nation are about national security. Greenland is a self-governing territory of Denmark, and in a show of solidarity, the leaders of France, Germany, the UK, and other countries issued a joint statement with the Prime Minister of Denmark, Mette Frederiksen, calling on the U.S. to respect its sovereignty. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
You're listening to a program previously aired on WPFW.